Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. And Happy New Year! The Astrophysics Podcast is now 2 years old, and we have officially started our third season. So, last summer, I gave myself a little break for a month, and rather than interview another new astrophysicist, I was joined once again by my wife, Professor Abigail Pollan, and we just had a casual episode answering any questions people had about the universe. After that episode aired, I soon discovered that it was much more popular than any of my other episodes. I think I'd probably been trying too hard to get a new guest on every week, when I think a lot of my listeners just want to hear some casual conversation about astrophysics. So for my New Year's resolution, I'm going to try to shake things up a little bit. I'll still have a good number of excellent new guests, but I'll also try to bring back some of my earlier guests, and I resolved to change up some of my questions, so I'm not always asking the same exact questions every time, probably. Most importantly, I'll have a few episodes each year just dedicated to astrophysics Q&A. I'm going to start this New Year's resolution by bringing back Dr. Pollan once more, and we will once again answer any questions our listeners have about the universe and also questions about the lives of those of us who make a career out of studying astrophysics. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast.
You know to be quiet during this part because I'll use anything you say can and will be used against you. All right.
Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast.
Yeah, good. All right. I can get started. Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I'm Paul Duffel, and my guest today, once again, is Dr. Abigail Pollan, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Purdue University. Dr. Pollan, thank you for joining me on this wonderful research program of astrophysics.
I'm glad to be here.
You weren't expecting the intro to be that good, were you?
No, it's just so excellent.
Anyway, good. So this is, we're doing another Astro Q&A because at least it seemed to me to be the most popular segment that we did. And I decided to bring back Abby, of course, because she's my favorite guest.
It better be.
So first of all, actually, maybe I'll talk about the, I guess, Happy New Year. And I'm going to talk about my, you know, so far, you know, every episode has been, I have a new guest on, a new astrophysicist, and I've typically asked them the same series of questions, which I'm kind of embarrassed by. So the next upcoming year, I'm hoping to change, to shake up the format a little bit. I'll still have my guests. I have some episodes I've already recorded, but I'm hoping to have a little more variety. So we have episodes a little more loose like this, where we're doing Q&A, and I hope to interview people I've talked to before and just talk about a specific science thing. Because you know, I don't want to. I'm worried that this format will get a little repetitive after a while. So we're hoping that it'll be, you know, fun, and I'm going to try my best to come up with new questions so that I'm not repeating myself too much on this podcast. But I want to start out, it's the new year, I thought I'd start out by talking a little bit about what's been going on with us, first of all, in our lives, and you know, if we want to, we still have a baby.
Yes, that's we still have the baby, yes.
It's mainly what's been going
She's
on.
Still a baby.
It's mainly what's been going on in our lives.
Wonderful baby.
Anything, yes, that we're very happy about that. Anything you want to say about that?
About the baby?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. She's great. She's crawling and waving and clapping. It's
yes.
Wonderful.
She clapped for us on Christmas Day as her Christmas present to us.
Yes, she was opening presents and clapped the first time. It's like a movie.
Yeah. but also I would like to talk about what's been going on with us in research over the past year. Obviously, it's been hard, you know, it's hard to do as much research in a year where you have a child, you have your first child. And so it's hard to get as much done, but of course our students are still hard at work.
Absolutely.
Do you want to talk about what your students have been working on?
Sure. I have a number of students. I think we'll probably talk about the one we share a little bit later. But but for the most part, my students are interested right now in some of these mysteries that are being revealed by JWST observations.
Okay.
So we've talked about JWST in your podcast several times, the fairly new space telescope that's allowing the fields of science to look further into the infrared and into dimmer objects. So in supernovae, a lot of the time this looks like looking at supernovae significantly after they exploded.
So in other words, so you're saying looking into the infrared, that's what James Webb telescope does. But then why does that mean looking, you're saying that in supernovae that translates to looking at it much later?
No. That's the dim part.
That's the dim part. Oh, because we're seeing things that are very dim. Fainter.
So really infrared is notoriously difficult from the ground because a huge part of it, the infrared wavelengths, are blocked by interference from our sky. We call those telorics. And so we're limited on ground-based telescopes in the infrared to pretty bright objects. So for supernovae, we're very excited to have a space-based telescope that allows us to look at things that are dimmer, which means things that are older in supernovae, right? They've been fading for longer.
Right. So if it's dimmer, first of all, it can mean much further away, but also it can mean, you can follow the supernova for longer because as it gets dimmer and dimmer, you can see what it does after it's would have normally faded out of your view.
And for supernovae, the longer you watch them, the more interior to the explosion you get to see because the outer layers, as they expand, become more transparent. So you get to see into the core of the explosion. So
Right. So supernovae, they're these so bright, hot explosions, and at first they're relatively opaque, and then as they expand and expand, they become more and more transparent. And then basically, so the more transparent they are, the further into them you can you can probe, and so you can see what's going on deeper in the interior of the supernova. Right.
And so this interior is something that we have trouble seeing from the ground, and it is hopefully the key to distinguishing between many theories of what creates these stellar explosions. So my students are working on the theoretical side of this problem, trying to model supernovae in these regimes to answer things like what are the innermost elements, do they create dust, things like that, so we can compare and answer some of these weird features we're starting to see with JWST.
Okay, so your students are building computer models of supernovae that are trying to predict what they will look like at these late times in the infrared.
Yes.
And to see, like, okay, this type of, you know, if a supernova exploded like this, it will look like this in the infrared. Yep. And if you exploded like this, it'll look like this.
Yep. So I have one student, Tess Hoover, working on what the cores of a specific type of supernova, type 1A supernovae, would look like at these late phases. And I have another student, Colin Mockery, who's interested in how these supernovae interact with dust at these late times. So,
great. I have a whole bunch of them. So the big sort of things, I guess, then going on in my group right now, I have one student who is almost at the stage of defending his thesis. He's going to defend his PhD thesis in May, I guess, or April or May or something
probably
like
April.
That. Probably April.
He's got to graduate in May.
Well, whatever. Anyway, that's Rana, and he has been doing a lot of great work with gamma ray bursts, which are these bright bursts of gamma rays that we see from across the edge of the observable universe. They're so bright, we can see them for really great distances. And they're caused by a couple of different things, but ultimately we expect they involve a black hole eating a whole bunch of gas and shooting out a bunch of material, moving collimated jet of material, moving at very close to the speed of light, within like 99.9999% of the speed of light, these jets, basically, Rana has been making all these predictions for what they should look like, and some of that has been collaborating with observers to compare with their data, some of it is his own work on theoretically understanding what we can know, what we can say about we call them GRBs, gamma ray bursts, based on how long the duration of them is. And then I have another student. Well, I don't know if I want to list off every
Paul
single
has
one.
So many students. Paul has more students than anybody else in our department.
I guess so. Rana has submitted a paper on that on gamma ray bursts, which is exciting. And then we also have, I guess I should say, we also have another student that we are sort of co-advising.
Yeah, which is something. If grad students are listening to us, it's a great situation to try to figure out a co-advisor. That's what I had, and you get to kind of get the best worlds of both expertises.
In the best case scenario, you're getting the good side of each advisor.
And, you know, you also get somebody else to go to if you're having, you know, any kind of communication difficulties or anything like that with one or the other.
Yeah, that actually helps a lot with mentorship, is if you have more than one voice to listen to. Because there's a lot of sanity checks when you just have one person. Sometimes they don't always know what the right answer is.
Yeah,
the
we're
best
still learning how to do this, too. but let's talk about Miranda.
Right. So Miranda just submitted a paper and is currently in the referee process of that paper and basically she's done this these calculations of supernova remnants. So supernova remnants are these basically supernova hundreds of years after they explode.
Instead of late time, when I say JWST, I meant a year after they explode, whereas right. Miranda's interested in hundreds to thousands of years after they explode.
Right. So there are great examples. If you're on Google Images, you can look for great examples of classic supernova remnants, like the Crab Nebula is one of them.
Tycho supernova remnant.
The Tycho supernova remnant. That used to be my favorite supernova remnant.
Yes, once upon a time.
Looks like a big ball of cauliflower, which is really cool. There's the Cassiopeia A, yes. Which is a supernova remnant that our colleague Danny Milisavljevic has done a lot of great work on observing with JWST. And then there's my new favorite supernova remnant.
Yes, everybody's new favorite.
Which is called PA30. And if you just Google PA30, you're going to find like a helicopter part or something
So you have to Google PA30 remnant.
or PA30 nebula or something like that.
Supernova.
PA30 supernova.
Astrophysics.
But it is this crazy. So all these other examples of supernova remnants, these are all basically old supernovae that exploded in the Milky Way. So they would have been visible to the naked eye on Earth, typically. Mm-hmm. PA30 is another example of that there was historical observations of it in
one of, I believe, seven historic supernovae, something like that.
Yeah. And it was observed in 1152?
1181.
1181. What was I thinking with 1152?
No idea.
Okay, anyway. You know better than I do. But anyway, 1181, it's sometimes called supernova 1181.
Mm-hmm. And it was observed in China and the Middle East.
And we now know, now after observing PA30, we now know, and looking at where it existed in the historical records, we now know the time that it had exploded, and it is coincident with what those historical records said. But the crazy thing about PA30 is what it looks like.
It looks totally different from any other supernova remnant we've seen.
It looks like basically a big spiky ball.
Yeah, if you're old, a Kush ball.
Yeah, so I described it. I used to describe it as the Kush ball remnant, and then none of my grad students knew what that was. And so I was. So
but if you're over like 25, maybe you played with a Kush ball.
Maybe, but anyway, that's 90s kids. So I called it the Kush ball, but it looks like almost like a dandelion or like a.
That's another good one.
Nice,
yeah.
Perfect spherical ball of sort of spikes that go outward.
An anemone. Not an anemone. What am I thinking of? It doesn't matter. Urchin.
Sea urchin. Yeah, exactly. So, what's crazy is, like, I think if you're an observer, it might be like, oh, it's another supernova that looks weird. But if you're a theorist who does fluid dynamics, like I am and like you are.
It's mind-blowing.
We're like, how do you make something that perfect? It doesn't make any sense just by chance.
That perfect or that spiky. Yeah. It's perfectly spherical.
The spikes are nicely uniformly distributed around it. It's like, who put those there? Right, it's really hard to explain. Just for basic.
Every fluid dynamicist I show this to just kind of sits there and stares at it and goes, what?
How do you do that? How do you do that just with fluid dynamics? And so basically what Miranda has done is she's basically shown that it is at least possible to make that morphology using basically if the remnant is cooled really efficiently, if you reduce, if you have some mechanism that's removing thermal energy, like radiating away somehow really rapidly, it cools these you have this fluid instability that gets, that drives these very sharp spiky fingers really naturally. It gives a very perfect sort of natural explanation for the remnant. It doesn't, of course you can't, just from that it isn't a proof that that's how it happened,
but I can take a moment to brag about our student and say currently it is the only start to finish model that does look like this remnant that's been modeled and simulated on the computer. There are other ideas.
There's lots of ideas people have put out, but nobody's actually done a 3D computer simulation
except
for Miranda. She's the only one in the world who has done that made it look like that,
and it is a plausible explanation for this remnant.
So we're still, of course, that begs other questions, like why do you get why does this remnant have so much cooling, why do other remnants not? But it's that's a very exciting result, and it's been submitted, and she's currently in the process with the referee.
Pretty positive referee report. A lot to do, but pretty positive.
But that's kind of like, that's kind of what you want, is they have a lot of comments, but they're generally positive.
Yep. You want them to give you things that will make your paper better.
Yeah. So that's all good news. And so we're anything else to report on the science-y front? There's that's a lot.
That's a lot. The Vera Rubin Observatory just started observing. We're going to get real data from them in early, well, maybe around when you're listening to this. I'm not sure when this episode's going to air.
It's funny, though, because we talked about that last Q&A.
Did we?
So that's probably not...
They've been doing commissioning runs, they've been doing testing runs, but we're going to start getting alerts from them pretty soon.
Okay, in terms of, like, when they see something is in this image that wasn't in the previous image.
Yes, so that's a new supernova, a new transient. That's going to start pretty soon, I think, before March. I get timelines of these things mixed up because I'm also involved in several other things that are starting up right now. So it's
And that's, of course, a very big deal. The Rubin Observatory is a big deal to people in many different fields, but we know that it's definitely a big deal to people who work on transients. So because they just take so many big pictures of a large field of view, and you can go to two images and say, is there something in this image that wasn't in that image? And then maybe that's a new supernova or a new something. Yeah.
Currently, we're in the field where we've observed a couple thousand supernovae over human history.
Right.
And in the first year of Rubin, we should instead see a couple hundred thousand in just 1 year.
In just 1 year.
Yep.
Anyway, this is supposed to be an Astro Q&A, and so we're going to start out, so basically we'll do what we did last time, which is I have a list of questions, and Abby has a list of questions. Sorry, Dr. Pollen has a list of questions.
Did you say Pollen?
No, I didn't say Pollen. I said Pollen. I know your last name. So we're going to give, and we haven't seen the other person's questions, so we're going to ask them and see what we come up with on the top of our head. I'm going to try, I have some questions that are about, like, not specifically about astrophysics, but about, like, how science is done and how...
Okay.
So I'm going to start with those. I don't know if you have any of those.
Not really. I have some ones that could be related in that category.
Well, the first question I want to ask, this is actually a question, this is my most commonly unsolicited email question that I just get an email about, which is, and I apologize if I don't answer emails because I really, I'm just...
Is it, can I be in your group?
Is it? No, that's, okay, that is technically the most common question I get is, I am a student from this country. I want to come to Purdue. Can I be in your group?
And for anyone asking about that, you have to go through the general application process. We can't just take people. We don't get to choose.
But so this is the most common question that I get asked from podcast listeners, which is, it'll be somebody who's interested in science. Maybe they got their bachelor's degree a while, but they're interested in going back into science. Mm-hmm. What would be a good advice for how to get started and like how to start on the track to going to grad school and that sort of thing?
That's a hard one. I think you're maybe more equipped to answer that.
I am more equipped because I did exactly that.
He did exactly this.
But I'll ask you first.
But, there's the official ways, there's the unofficial ways. And I think a really good way to start is to reach out to whatever your local university is department and see if you can audit some classes, depending how long it's been. Right. If it's been years and years, you might want to do a refresher. We don't mind, I can't speak for everyone. I personally don't mind if people sit in my classes so long as I'm not above the fire code in terms of full seats.
as long as there's enough seating for everybody. Yeah.
But nowadays there might be better advice than that, honestly, because there's all the internet courses and that kind of thing. But reaching out and trying to talk to some current people in the field is good.
So if you want,
should answer this. This is what you did. This is Paul's career trajectory. What,
your answer is basically right. I'll modify it a little bit. Mm-hmm. When you apply, eventually you'll want to apply. If you were interested in getting into science, you'll want to apply to a grad schools. You want to apply to many of them, and to have the best chance of getting in. It's extremely competitive. Even like for anywhere you want to apply, it's extremely competitive. So your best chance of getting in is having good letters of recommendation and having a lot of research experience and I would say not just looking for your local university, definitely go look at your local university, but not just for courses. You should be trying to find professors in the university that would be interested in giving you some research experience.
Yeah.
And your best bet with that is to be willing to do that for free.
That's unfortunate, but true.
Is basically to go, honestly, a lot of times it's about cold calling. If you're in a place that has like a local city university and stuff, they will often have a lot of professors that are actively doing research, but probably don't have as much funding as they do at some of the bigger universities. So they may welcome having somebody there to do, who's willing to just do free research for them. But it gives you research experience that you can put on your CV, and it gives you potentially a letter of recommendation from that professor.
And when we say work for free, we mean monetarily, not recognition-wise. You should always...
you should always be recognized for your work, of course.
If you're doing research that results in a paper, you're doing research that results in part of a paper, you should be included on it.
You should be included on the paper. But try your best to get involved with and get to know faculty at your local university, ideally do some research, if you can get published, even better. But generally, do some research and get some research on your CV, and then also have have that helps with letters of recommendation. Yep. Which, if you've been outside of the field for a while, it'd be hard to find those letters of recommendation.
I suspect there's. If you've been doing something that is science-like and does have research in industry, I think a lot of this is unnecessary. You still need letters of recommendation. You still need a little bit, but research experience outside of pure academia also does count.
It does, but it helps. Anyway, I think, honestly, I think it doesn't hurt to try. Mm-hmm. My answer is that's what I would do, is I would look for opportunities to do research. And know that there's like a whole year-long cycle of applying to grad schools.
Yeah, so that's a really important thing to know, is you apply in the winter to get in the following fall.
Yeah, so you have to be ready with all of your materials, applying early in the winter.
Yeah,
and then
kind of November-ish.
Something like that.
And then you'd start grad school the following September.
Yeah. Think of what local resources there are available at, okay, so that was my question.
Yes.
Do you have one?
Sure. All right, here's a related. What advice would you give to students who love space but feel a little bit more intimidated by the math aspect? of physics.
Okay, who love space but are intimidated by the math. Well, I would say, I would say look for what you do feel like you have skills, your strong skill set in. So even if you may feel like you don't have strong math skills, you may have, have good programming skills, and some people would say programming is math in some sense, but it is a different skill set. So that's another, your math skills are not that strong, you can still potentially even do astrophysics theory. Mm-hmm. If you have good coding skills, and if you like coding.
You're right. That's a really important aspect I want to always add to this is, it's not just about how strong you are in a skill, because growth mindset, you can get better.
That's right.
Right. It's you are not stuck with the math skills that you come into college with.
Right.
But you do have to enjoy what you do for a living. I hope you enjoy what you do for a living. You shouldn't go into science or academia if you don't enjoy it.
Right.
So if you're not enjoying math, it is a little difficult.
Yeah.
Because it is a huge part of what we do.
Right. So if you enjoy math, but you feel like other people around you are better than you or something like that, first of all, that might just be in your head.
Yes.
But secondly, it's also something that you can improve. You know, that's
absolutely
definitely a skill that you can hone over time. I mean, that's why we have courses for it, right?
Mm-hmm. None of us came in knowing the amount of mathematics that we used as professors.
Right. And so that's another piece of it. The other thing I would say is, like, not all aspects of it require the same amount of math. Certainly, mm-hmm. when you're doing, a lot more theoretical astrophysics, mm-hmm. there is a lot more mathematics, but you can be, you know, and of course there's going to be mathematics in all these fields, in all these branches, but if you're doing observing, you don't have to, there's still math involved, but it's not the focus, right. And if you're doing instrumentation, mm-hmm. There's always going to be math, but it's not the same level of
the part of it that needs to bring you joy.
Right. Exactly. I don't know. So you think that's a complete answer?
Yeah, I like that answer.
Okay, good. How about this one? This is a pretty vague one. I like the vague questions.
Mm-hmm.
What part of your work involves judgment or intuition rather than calculation?
Ooh, that's a good one.
So good, we're not going to have a good answer for it.
So all of it should be backed up by calculation at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Let me capture that. But there is a lot of what we do that you develop an intuition with experience.
Yes.
So, like, exactly what we were talking about with the PA30 nebula.
Right.
Right? To be able to look at that and go, whoa, that is weird. We don't know how that's made. That
right.
looks different
that
in a
looks,
way that is mysterious.
Right. That looks unnatural to someone who knows fluid dynamics.
Right.
Right.
So things like that come up all the time.
Right.
You know, in my field, we'll get all this data coming in, and, you know, ideally we have machines that tell us this one's weird, go look at it. But often you'll have a person go, hey, that's weird in a way that we don't know. We don't know why it's weird. We
right.
should look into this. We can learn from this.
Right.
And I think that's the biggest part of where intuition comes in for me is mm-hmm. being able to point myself into where the mysteries are.
Right. And you see a whole bunch of data and you go like, hang on, that is unusual.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a good, like, this
right.
this isn't well explained. We need to dig into this
mm-hmm.
further. What pieces you need to actually stare at for longer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. I would agree with that. Yeah, I would say, well, like you said, I think the judgment or intuition part is really, it's experience. It's how long you've been doing this. Like, a lot of times, I talk about this all the time, my students will sometimes
yeah.
think that I'm magic because
oh,
they're like,
yeah.
I can't figure out why this code isn't working.
And you'll
it's
go,
giving me
it's
this.
It's probably
I'm
a
like,
pointer.
Well, if you change this thing, if you, you know, what if you add this, like, if you smooth this out? And they're like, that's probably not going to do anything. I'm like, well, try it.
Just,
and then,
just give it a
and
go.
And then, like, they spend a whole month trying other things. And they're like, all right, I'll try the thing that Paul told me to do. And then
yep.
it's like, it works perfectly. Like, how did you know?
Right. It's
like,
not that we're magic. It's,
no.
it's that we've been doing this for longer.
We've been doing it for a long time. And we've obviously made that mistake before.
Yes.
And so we know we've learned from that. And
yep.
that's where
yep,
the intuition
yep.
comes from.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I think it's your turn.
Alright, hold on, let me just... Alright. What's your favorite accidental discovery?
Oh, geez. My favorite accidental discovery?
Yeah, like not of yours
In history of science?
Yeah, history of science question.
So the one that comes to mind is the one that that Daniel, your brother, told me about on the episode of the podcast that we've recorded already and it's not going to be airing yet.
Do you want to spoil that?
I'll spoil it. It's fine. It'll make it sound like I came up with it. It was the discovery of the cosmic microwave background. He was telling me about how they had an antenna that was just trying to detect they were just trying to measure radiation, its background radiation, and different directions. Most of that microwave background was coming from the atmosphere, and so they point their antenna in different directions, and they could see that okay, if you point it straight up, it will not be as much because there's less atmosphere to go through, and if you go towards the horizon, there'll be more atmosphere to go through, and the shape looks fine. But then there was an overall background that you would be left with that in all directions, and they were trying to understand that, and it's this systematic error that they had that they couldn't explain, and they just had to try many, many things and figure out like what was the systematic error that was causing it. And once they ruled out enough things, they eventually came to the conclusion that it was like a new source in the universe of radiation, which is now what we call the cosmic microwave background, the CMB. It's called background because it was originally thought of as a background of this experiment, and so but it's this leftover radiation from the Big Bang, and they discover it that way. And what Daniel was telling me, and he'll say it again in the
episode. I was gonna say you should probably save this.
Nah, he gets it, it'll be spoiled for him, and it's okay. This is a sales pitch for his episode. but when he was telling me was there was another group that was doing the same experiment, but they found this background. They discovered the background, but they said we don't know what this systematic error is. It's just some weird error in our experiment. We can't figure it out. And they didn't dig further. And so, they could have had the Nobel Prize, but they...
Sad.
But, yeah, I think that's a pretty good accidental discovery. Yeah. Anyway, I thought that was a pretty good story.
I always like the radio astronomy ones around, like the LGMs and, you know, the LGMs.
The little green men.
The little green men, yes.
Was this with pulsars?
Or? I thought this was FRBs, but
I think this was pulsars.
Pulsars, yes.
So what are you?
Well, so there was a new radio source, right? Mm-hmm. That we didn't know what they were. If it was pulsars, these were discovered by Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who famously didn't get enough credit for this discovery.
Yes.
But discovered a new radio source that just kept going off in space. Some were regular, some once upon a time, but... But
it was this perfectly regular periodic emitter, which we now call a pulsar.
Yep. And it was too regular, so regular that people were like, it can't be an astrophysical object. Like, there must be something wrong.
Right.
And kind of tongue-in-cheek started calling them LGMs, little green men, for aliens.
right, because it must be an evidence of an intelligence because it's doing the same.
I think it was more tongue in cheek. I think they were saying your data's not right. These aren't real, and it turns out they were, and they were pulsars of rapidly spinning neutron stars.
Right.
Related to that, I also like famously there was a radio signal. I think this was Parkes telescope, maybe Green Bang.
Oh, yes. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, there was this discovery of this radio signal and this radio telescope that just happened to show up around noon every day.
They were calling them Peritons.
Yeah, Peritons.
At first they didn't realize that they were happening around noontime.
Right. They just had a period of about a day.
Yeah, yep. that every so often they'd get this radio signal.
It turns out this was lunchtime, and it was a signal from the microwave in the lunchroom. So now, if you go and work at a radio telescope, we typically put the microwaves in Faraday cages.
Right, so you have this whole big cage that the microwave's inside of, and that you can't start the microwave until it's put inside, until the thing is closed and inside. Now, the microwave itself is supposed to be a Faraday cage,
yeah.
Which is a little scary, but I think my instinct...
very, very low radiation.
It's when people put, instead of hitting the stop button, they like hit the open button on the microwave before it's, and then, so there's this like brief moment when it opens and is letting the radiation out.
I mean, microwaves have also gotten significantly better at self-shielding over time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, I love that story too. Yeah. Because it's kind of a great example of like, hang on, they're all clustering around you.
Right, a period of 24 hours.
They should always be at noontime.
Hold on.
What limits your research more? Technology, funding, or ideas?
Okay, gut answer, I wanted to say definitely funding. but sometimes technology. But that's also related to funding. Technology is limited because funding is limited, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. the telescope that I would need to go answer some questions doesn't exist yet, but mm-hmm. it should and it could if we were better at funding things.
But that's if you're an observer.
But even as a theorist, it's mm-hmm. you know, it's technological development of computers sometimes, it's mm-hmm. code development, but all of these are all tied back to money, and also my personal energy levels are tied back to funding. so much of my life is applying to funding, so I have money to pay my students or myself or to buy time on a computer, anything like that, to go after these problems.
Right. And if funding was more readily available, you wouldn't be constantly having necessarily to apply for every single grant.
Yeah, it's easily 25% of my time.
So that's a okay. Yep. Good money.
Yep. Yep. Money.
All right. Well, then let me, before I mm-hmm. move on, I'll have a follow-up question. What's the most frustrating technical limitation you work around? Is there any kind of frustrating thing that you get?
I can't say money again.
We do. That's true. We do. That is true. We work around the fact that we don't have funding all the time, basically yep. putting our students on more TA positions uh-huh. and things like that.
Yep. Computing time. Computing. So, we're constantly trying to play games to make sure our codes are the most efficient as they possibly could be. Mm-hmm. And still, with the best software technology and the best computers we have today, not all problems are possible to answer in full.
Sure.
Now, part of our job is saying, okay, well, what parts of, say, you don't want to just throw all physics that exists into your computer and hit go. That's impossible, and also we probably wouldn't learn much from it.
Right.
But, because then we'd just get another universe we could look at, right? We can look at our universe.
It wouldn't be obvious what was causing what to happen.
Just like when we look out into space, right? You need to tune things like an experiment. Right. But it's still, so our job is to play games of what can we drop and what can we tune, what are we changing in terms of variables to actually learn something.
What's the question we actually want answered and what physics do we need to include in order to answer that question?
But even playing all of those games, I often will run into a problem that's just not possible to answer with current computer technology, right? It would take my year's worth of computing time to run a fraction of answering the question.
We should say Purdue has some of the best computing facilities of any university that we've even been at. Well, yep. I mean,
I'm saying humans.
Like
humans can't
Purdue
answer
has,
some of
Purdue
these
has
questions.
Some incredible. I mean, we're very blessed to be able to do the kind of research we can because of the mm-hmm. just the huge amount of computing power that's at Purdue. Mainly that's because we're an engineering school, and engineering needs all this computing power, and we kind of piggyback off of that. But
on the observing side of what I do, again, I'm interested in these really faint objects. So technologically, we're limited there a lot. Where mm-hmm. there's only so much time on a given telescope. There's 365 days in a year.
Right.
How many days can you give to one scientist if my data that I'd like would take a full night to take?
Right.
And that's for one object, say, or maybe four objects per night.
Right.
If I want to build a statistical sample, I need a telescope to myself.
So. Okay. All right. Do you have a question?
Sure. Let's go. I'm going to go move us more into science-y questions.
Absolutely.
Like kind of the big, broad ones. And then maybe we can go back to whimsy a little later. All right. So I have one that's mm-hmm. kind of fun, but kind of vague.
I love those.
Could the laws of physics be different somewhere else in the universe?
Okay, good. Could the laws of physics be different? So that's partly a philosophical question, right? Because if you're really thinking about that question philosophically, the answer is no, because whatever the definition of what it means to be the laws of physics is whatever the laws the universe obeys throughout the universe, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, it may mean that the current laws of physics that we think are true, we need to modify them in order to, you know, if those laws were different in other places in the universe.
We can rephrase it too. The parts of the laws of physics that dominate in our current universe and our local universe, are those universal?
So, like, things like the speed of light, mm-hmm. or...
Sure.
Basically, I guess, you know, in some sense, there's observational constraints on those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. There is a physical size to the observable universe. It's how far, you know, a light ray can travel since the beginning of time, and it's a finite distance, and so there's only so far that we can see to. So then, yeah, you can say, like, if, you know, in that pocket, the best of our understanding, those physical laws or the physical constants behave in the way that we the same way in all those different and overall on those scales, it looks like the universe is reasonably uniform. So if the laws of physics were different somewhere else, it would be very surprising, because they it would be hard to explain how the universe remained so uniform. But of course, you can't rule out what is going on beyond mm-hmm. where you can see, right? Beyond the furthest distance that a light ray could travel since the beginning of time. So it could be, you know, there's no way you can rule out that the universe looks different beyond that distance. But there's no, first of all, there's just no obvious reason to assume that it would be different. I think that we work under the assumption that things are, that those laws are basically the same everywhere mm-hmm. until proven otherwise.
Yep.
Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I like that answer.
Okay, good. All right, so I guess I'll do another... I'll do another science question. Black holes are a really popular thing to ask about, and so there's a whole variety of questions I can do, but why don't I summarize the black hole questions with the following question. What's the deal with black holes?
I also have a black hole question.
Okay.
What really happens at the center of a black hole?
Okay. What do you want to start?
I mean, sure.
What's the deal with black holes?
I mean, you're the one who teaches GR. You're better at this. So black holes are actually one of the really cool phenomena in astrophysics, just on kind of a theory tangent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So black holes are a natural consequence of general relativity, that there are these singularities in space-time. And when Einstein did his theory of general relativity, he said, well, but those are probably just, you know, don't worry about those.
Weird solutions that don't make any sense.
Don't worry about those. Because we get those. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of akin to dividing by zero, you know.
Sometimes you get weird solutions to the equations and you go, okay, well, realistically, we know those aren't real answers.
Right, don't worry about them. And then it turns out, nope, worry about them. Those those are black holes.
Real astrophysical phenomena that exist.
Singularities in space-time.
So like you said, I teach a course in general relativity. I'm going to be teaching it again this coming semester. And hopefully at some point writing a textbook about general relativity.
Please do that. So, you know, someday if I have to teach it, then can you use that textbook?
So general relativity is is a whole subject that was essentially invented by Einstein, although obviously many other people contributed to it. But basically, Einstein worked out the idea that gravity could be described purely in terms of geometry and the curvature of what we call space-time. And so massive objects curve space-time, and they cause things around them to cause, first of all, distortion of the path of objects past past these massive objects, which is what causes the phenomenon of gravity. But then the idea is, if you get more and more massive, it makes it distorts space-time more and more. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I mean, eventually it's so distorted that nothing can escape. There are no trajectories that can escape the black hole. And then that's when it's a black hole.
Yeah.
The idea is, you can think of it sort of like, you know, you can imagine it in terms of escape velocity. So if you have if you, I don't know the actual numbers here, but if you think of the escape velocity from the surface of the Earth, it's how much, you know, based on how much energy you need to escape the Earth's gravitational field. And the more massive an object is, and the more compact an object is, the higher the escape velocity will be. And so when you basically, have a certain...
By an object there, do you mean the object escaping or the planet?
Meaning the object itself, so like the planet, meaning the object it's trying to escape. So the more massive, like whether it's a planet or a star, whatever it is, will have the larger mass it has, the larger escape velocity there is from the surface of that. And the smaller it is, the smaller radius, you know, it is, that also increases the escape velocity. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is you can compute what that escape velocity is. And if, for example, if you take the sun, off the top of my head, I don't know the escape velocity from the surface of the sun, but the smaller you make it, the faster the escape velocity is. And once you make that radius about 3 kilometers, mm-hmm. If you could condense the sun into about 3 kilometers, the escape velocity eventually is the speed of light.
Right.
And then basically what that means is that even a light ray can't escape the surface, which means that nothing can, which means not only can they not escape, but they also are guaranteed to move inward. Mm-hmm. And so that would mean that once something is, an object is that compact, it has to collapse into a black hole. It has to collapse and collapse and keep collapsing into a singularity, basically.
So that's what we call the Schwarzschild radius.
Yes. That 3 kilometers for the sun. Any amount of mass, it's basically proportional. Mm-hmm. The what they call the Schwarzschild radius is it's proportional to the mass of the object.
Right.
So for the sun, it's 3 kilometers.
So for the sun, that would mean if the sun were a black hole, the solar mass black hole,
mm-hmm.
nothing that got closer than 3 kilometers could ever escape.
Right, exactly. And it's sort of, it's related to the speed of light, and the idea that nothing can escape the black hole is the same as the idea that nothing can move faster than the speed of mm-hmm. light. It's an interconnected concept. And so that speed limit sign turns into a one-way sign at the edge of the black hole. And so it's a related concept.
So Einstein thought these weren't real. How did we discover that they were?
That's a great example of a scientific discovery that was slowly accepted over time. Mm-hmm. So the first example of us actually observing a black hole was Cygnus X-1, which is an X-ray binary, mm-hmm. and it's basically a star has a companion that's a black hole.
Yep.
And it's that black hole is pulling gas off the star, and it's creating a disk that falls onto the black hole, which creates really bright radiation. And basically, that was the first black hole that we actually, because we can observe that radiation as matter falls into the black hole, we've been able to use that to find black holes. That was sort of the first example of a black hole that we were able to see, in a sense. You don't directly see the black hole itself.
See that it's there.
You see the stuff that's falling into it.
Yeah.
And so that was the first example, and that, again, like, that convinced some people, but then other people were not convinced enough by that, mm-hmm. Over time, there were more and more examples of things that we've been able to detect. For example, the stars at the center of the Milky Way mm-hmm. orbit the black hole at the center of the Milky Way, and they have very specific trajectories where you can use to figure out what the mass is, the black hole. We also have directly imaged now with our Event Horizon Telescope mm-hmm. the black holes at the center of M87 and the black hole at the center of our own galaxy. Those are called supermassive black holes because they're millions to billions of times the mass of the sun.
Supermassive.
Supermassive. and then, oh, the other example, of course, is gravitational waves. Yep.
Another thing that Einstein said we'd never detect.
Right. He thought it was too, it was, he believed in them as real solutions to the equations and that they would exist in the universe, but just that not
technology
that,
would never be good enough to directly detect them.
Yes, so it's not good to bet against humanity in that sense. So that's another example of how we've detected them by detecting the merging of two black holes. We can they create ripples in the fabric of space-time that we can detect here on Earth with the with gravitational wave observatories. So anyway, there's many now lines of evidence. So basically, you would have to be really dug in to not believe in black holes at this point. There's just too many direct, very direct forms of evidence that they exist and are doing things out in the universe. So that's what the deal with black holes is, I guess. did I answer your question too?
What happens at the center?
Formally, no, there's no way to, like, in a scientific sense, there's no way to know the answer to that question because it's hidden behind what they call the event horizon. And since no light can escape, formally, there's no way to scientifically determine the answer to that. But, we can surmise roughly that everything, all of that matter from that black hole condenses into a single point at the center, but it's very hard to say what that means exactly. Okay, that's as good an answer as I'm going to come up with for that question.
Cool.
Is it my turn again since you did
so.
One? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, here's one. Here's this is a good one. How do we know that the universe is expanding?
We've talked, I mean, you and I have talked about this on the podcast before, too.
Yeah, we did? Okay. Yeah. Well, I have a bad memory, so. how do we know? Right. I mean, I know how I have enough good enough memory to know how we know the universe is expanding, but why don't you give it an answer?
So basically, when we look out into the universe, we notice that things become increasingly far apart from everything else, like more than we expect. If the universe weren't expanding.
Sorry, what do you mean by the things become increasingly far apart from everything
else? So the further we look into the universe, the faster these galaxies seem to be moving away from us.
Right.
And that only makes sense if either we're real special and everyone hates us.
Everyone's moving away from us specifically.
Which is unlikely. Or if the space in between these galaxies is expanding.
So everything is moving away from everything else.
So if you could go to the next galaxy over, they'll also see that everything, as they look out into the universe, is increasingly moving away from them faster and faster as they look out.
Right. The further things are away from them, no matter what galaxy you're at, the further things are away, the faster they are moving away from them.
Because the space in between these galaxies, in between matter, is increasing.
So the basic idea about the universe expanding is it's not that when people think of the universe expanding, they often think it's stuff expanding into space.
Right.
But that's a misconception that it's really the space in between things that's expanding.
Yeah.
And we can tell that, in a few different ways, but the main way that we can tell that is because everything is expanding away from everything else. So every galaxy is expanding away from every other galaxy. Yeah. And so basically the idea is the space between these galaxies is growing.
Yeah. You can do a really fun exercise if you take a Hubble Deep Field image, for example, on your computer and scale it. Take the original scale and then increase the scale by 30%. And you can move around and center on any given galaxy and see that everything is further away from all the other galaxies. It looks like that's the center of the image being scaled away.
I'll have that as an exercise for my cosmology students sometimes. And I'll even, the old version of that is to use a photocopier with transparencies.
Yeah.
And nowadays you can just do that on a computer, of course.
Flash in between the two images.
Yeah. Okay, good. So that's how we know the universe is expanding, because everything is moving away from us, and the further out we look, the faster things are moving. Mm-hmm. That's the basic way we know.
So I have a related question to that.
Okay.
This one, I get asked a lot in public talks, mm-hmm. but do we think the universe has an end, and what does that look like?
That's a good question. We think that it has an end.
I interpret this as temporally the end, right? Like what happens?
Do we think the universe will die? End?
Will end? Yes. Not like what's at the edge of the universe. Like? Yes.
That's of course very difficult to say. We can say what it's doing now, mm-hmm. Which is it's expand. One, the very basic fact that we can say for certain is that it's expanding right now. And it has expanded over time, and it's actually kind of incredible because we can probe how the universe has expanded over time. So we know not only that it's expanding now, it was expanding in the past, and in fact, it's expanding faster now than it was expanding in the past, which means the universe is accelerating. It's actually gone through a little weird trajectory. It started out moving really fast. It started to decelerate, like you would imagine, like gravity trying to pull things back and keep them from expanding. Mm-hmm. But then it started to accelerate again. So things are moving faster and faster apart from each other. So if you just, we don't know for certain what happens in the future, right? Right. It might decelerate again and collapse for all we know. But our best understanding of the universe, what they call the Lambda CDM model, is the best understanding we have of cosmology. It suggests that the universe will not only continue expanding, but it'll continue accelerating, and everything will move apart from each other faster and faster and faster, and to the point that they call the heat death of the universe, when things are moving so apart so fast from each other that galaxies, basically the space is expanding so quickly that galaxies can no longer see each other because they're expanding away from each other essentially faster than the speed of light. The space between them is growing faster than a light ray can travel through it.
Right. So you're just isolated.
And so everything becomes isolated from everything else.
Yep.
So that's the current sort of understanding of it, but we don't know. Maybe something else happens after that point, because we don't know exactly what will happen in the future. But that's our current projection based on what
things continue as they currently are.
Right. Good.
Cool.
Is it my turn?
I guess so.
Okay. This is a good... Okay. I like this question. What's the difference between dark matter and dark energy?
That's a good question. It's a good question because it's often confused. So... I'll start with dark energy, since we were just actually talking about it.
Okay.
So dark energy is the name that we give to basically the fact that expansion of the universe is accelerating, right?
It's kind of that acceleration term. Responsible for that acceleration.
Yep.
There must be some force or energy that's causing the universe to expand faster and faster.
Right. So it's more of a concept than it is an actual... tangible.
Well, we found no way to directly probe it.
Right.
That's right. But I would say it's more than just a concept. We can measure that it's definitely there.
Right, it's definitely there. There's something causing this acceleration. We can quantify that.
But we call it dark energy. We call it dark energy as a name sort of because we really don't know what it is.
Yep.
But we know what it does, which is it causes the universe to accelerate.
Right. Whereas dark matter is actual mass that we know is in the universe because things behave gravitationally in consequence to that mass being there, mm-hmm. but it doesn't emit light.
Right.
So we can't see it. Literally, we can't see it. We can point our telescopes at it. We can't see it. We can just see things reacting to the fact that there is more mass there.
Right. So when we look at a galaxy, not only is most of the mass in that galaxy is in basically invisible mass that we call dark matter, and we can tell it's there basically it's matter that you can't see, and we can tell it's there because of its gravitational effect, but we haven't found any other way of
right.
directly interacting with it.
So they're actually very different things, not so related to each
right.
other.
Right. It's funny. So dark matter was discovered, well, first in the 50s and 60s, and it was another example of something that was slowly accepted over time by the scientific community. Dark energy is much more recent, well, maybe in the 90s discovered. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of funny they're given similar names in the sense that we call them this because we don't know what it is.
Except for, I think dark matter was probably given the name because it's literally dark.
Because it's literally dark. That's right. Whereas, it's literally matter that is dark and you can't see it.
Right, whereas dark energy is dark in the mysterious kind of way. We're yes. in the dark about what it yeah. is.
I mean, I think most phenomena in astrophysics are given names like that they're, that we don't know what the name is. We don't know what this is, yep. so we call it, you know, something dark matter. And then eventually we get a better understanding of it, but we still have the same name.
Yep.
But yeah, dark matter is a little bit more well understood in the sense that we have ways of probing the mm-hmm. fact. We know how it's distributed around galaxies.
Yeah, roughly. We can make maps of, like, you know, with enough observations, we can make pretty detailed maps of the dark matter distribution in right. galaxies.
Entirely based on its gravitational interaction. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is a more tangible thing, even though we don't know what it is exactly. We know that it's matter. We know that it's matter we can't see, and we can actually determine where it is. We know that it forms little halos around galaxies, yep. And so we know, you know, basically how, in a rough sense, we know how it's distributed. Mm-hmm. And we're getting better and better at determining yep. how it's distributed through
space. And there
space.
Are people who are still hoping that it's just emitting some energy level that we haven't mm-hmm. figured out yet.
Yes. You know? Yeah, and there continue to be experiments to try to detect it. You know, it may have some weak interaction with regular matter that we can mm-hmm. detect in an experiment.
Yep.
But yeah, so dark matter is a bit better understood. Dark energy is still pretty mysterious, mm-hmm. but we know that it is there because it causes the universe to accelerate. Okay, that's my question. Okay. I think it's your turn.
It's my turn. I'm going to go for something. I'm going to veer us back into the whimsy. I really like this question.
Okay.
And I like it because it's related to something that we get asked all the time.
Okay.
But it's a weird flavor of asking that question.
Okay.
So you ready?
Yes.
If aliens looked at Earth, could they see the dinosaurs?
If aliens looked at Earth, could they see the dinosaurs? If they were, 65 million light years away? Is that how long the dinosaurs were ago?
250 million.
They're 200, well, okay. It shows how much I know about dinosaurs. But basically, however many years back you want mm-hmm. them to be able to see, they would have to be living that far away in light
yep.
years.
Yep. I like this question because we get asked this all the time of what do you mean, like how long ago did something happen? And so I actually happen to know because I really like dinosaurs. that 250 million years is roughly a redshift of 0.02.
Okay.
So I very regularly look at supernovae that are that far away.
That are about a redshift.
So that were exploding temporally when the dinosaurs were right. roaming the Earth.
Very good. When that supernova was actually going off, right. you can say that.
So we should stop here because I think we're probably confusing people a little bit. Because we like to joke because one of the things we get asked always when an astrophysical event goes off is how long ago did that happen?
Right.
Right. Because if it's far away, we're receiving light that left that supernova, for example, 250 million years ago.
Right. And so it speaks to the fact that this is kind of a mind-blowing concept that the further away you're looking, the further back in time
yep.
you're looking.
Yeah.
But it also can be kind of maddening from our perspective because we did all this work to understand this supernova and all people want to know is how long ago was that? Like, they just want to know a time when that actually happened.
Oh, but it's cool.
But nevertheless, yeah. So the idea of that is very deep. That because light travels a certain rate, when we look at the sun, we're looking at what it looked like 8 minutes ago.
Yep. So aliens living around, you know, those stars before they exploded could see the dinosaurs if, you know, they had mm-hmm. such technology. And
if they had really high resolution telescopes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how. I don't know the likelihood.
For curiosity,
of that,
when I got this question, I did look up what the furthest exoplanet we discovered so far is, and that was closer to 25,000 light years.
Okay, so we wouldn't be able to see. Yeah. Well, they wouldn't. That's not dinosaur level.
No.
Right, because that's right, because all the exoplanets we've discovered would be in our galaxy.
Right.
Good. So okay. I got a question. Mm-hmm. Here's a good one. What's the most extreme thing in space? If you hadn't guessed, this is a subjective question.
It's the most extreme thing in space.
This is completely subjective, but in your opinion, what's the most extreme thing in space?
I don't know. We are. no. What's the most extreme thing in space?
Okay, how about this? Because you're trying to break it down in terms of, like,
extreme. I'm trying
extreme,
to break it down.
In
extreme
terms
is
of, like,
the most
the
energetic?
Most energetic or something like that?
Coolest?
No, definitely. You should be thinking, like, crazy, like interesting, like, crazy thing that happens in space. Like,
so much crazy things happen in space. Stars get eaten by black holes the time. So. We have binaries of these supermassive black holes out there. Like, whole stars explode.
Yeah. Well, which of those do you think is the most extreme, in your opinion? Your professional opinion as an astrophysicist. Opinion.
Probably the supermassive black hole binaries.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know.
So what do you consider, what makes you so...
They're real big.
They're very large. That's true. They can be...
They're extreme in that sense.
Like 10 billion times the mass of the sun. Black holes, they're like 10 billion suns.
Yeah. We also don't really know how they get close enough to each other to merge, which is really cool.
Yeah, that's still...
We do, but we don't.
there's still open debate about exactly how that happens, how they get close enough to merge.
And... There might be a supermassive black hole at the center of every galaxy, mm-hmm. or at least every massive galaxy, and we don't know. We're trying to figure that out. They're really cool.
They are very cool. I mean, it's an active research problem I work on. Supermassive black
hole binaries. What do you think? You've seen this question for a while. What do you think the most extreme thing out there is? You're
gonna have a better answer. I'm gonna say no. You already said it. The star getting eaten by a black hole.
Yeah,
that's cool.
That's cool.
A whole star just torn into shreds and chowed down by a black hole, and then it powers a bright jet of radiation that we can see from across the universe. Yep. I think that's pretty extreme.
Really cool. Yeah.
I mean, there's plenty of other things that are, like, physically more extreme if you want, but, like, I think that's kind of, like...
Yeah, it's a really cool problem. It's a messy problem. It's hard to solve, hard to model.
Right, how to describe...
I believe you've had TD people on here before. You've had the Brenna Mockler episode.
I had Brenna Mockler, and I had... I can't remember. I may have had another TD person on here. Tyler. Oh, yeah, I had Yvette Sendes.
I had Yvette Sendes, obviously.
And so both of them work on black holes eating stars.
So if you think those are extreme, we'll learn more about those. Those are great episodes. Yeah. Is it my turn again?
I think it's your turn. I think we're getting close to the end. So why don't you come up with your, like, best wrap-up question?
Oh, can I ask two more?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. So I like this question a lot. I'm going with full whimsy here. what is your favorite sci-fi movie and show, and did they get any of the science right?
Oh, man. favorite sci-fi movie and
show? Yeah.
I think...
We can throw books in there if you want to.
No, I think... Overall, my favorite is just Star Trek.
I knew that.
you already knew the answer to that for me. Is that what is your answer?
I mean, it's probably Star Trek at this point, too.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
I didn't watch Star Trek until I started dating this guy.
And, of course, they constantly get all of the science wrong.
Oh, yeah, it's horrible. The science is horrible.
It's not, like, and it varies episode by episode.
Honestly,
but, like,
I prefer just throwing the science out the window for my sci-fi, because if they try to do it so right and then mess up something obvious, I get annoyed.
Right. If they try to, like, go, you
like,
know,
you have to be really,
really,
really clever
To write a science fiction
one that doesn't end up annoying me.
Realistic, but that's kind of pointless.
I like the Andy Weir books in that sense.
Yeah. But yeah, I like Star Trek because it goes to that level where you're not supposed to really deconstruct the science.
It's more about
you're just supposed to have fun. Good.
Space diplomacy.
Space diplomacy. That's right. okay. What's your favorite Star Trek episode of all the series?
Masks. No, that's the first one. what's my favorite episode?
I'll tell you mine.
Okay, you go first.
My favorite is Darmok.
Darmok, that's an excellent choice.
All right. You don't have to give an answer.
No, I'm it's not masks.
Okay, good. All right, you had another one for me.
I have a wrap-up question, so if you want to go, yeah.
Actually, I'll have a final wrap-up question
fine.
But this is a good wrap-up question. Has studying the universe changed how you think about everyday life? I should ask this of all my guests.
Oh, yeah, it's a really good one. Yeah, it does. I mean, my job in general makes me changes how I feel about everyday life and how I approach it. I started this career as a little bit of a misanthrope. I didn't like people so much. I thought, hey, let me go into science because that's where I can be alone and sit in a corner and like just accomplish things and follow this physics and math that I like. And I have learned through this that not only is that not how science is done anymore, it's all about people. You have to be a good collaborator. I found that I enjoy that more than I thought I ever would, and that I need the people aspect of it. So for myself, right. That has changed dramatically.
That's interesting. That's almost certainly not the intended response for this, the intended interpretation of the question.
Yep.
But that's fun. But that, you know, you don't have to. That's no questions asked on the Astrophysics Podcast have to be answered in the way they're intended.
Studying the universe.
How has studying the universe changed the way you think about everyday life? And so that is, yes, it has.
Made me realize people are far more important.
Okay, great. For me, I think it permeates all kinds of little things of my life. Because I do so much computational fluid dynamics, anytime I see water doing something interesting, like when I was living in New York as a grad student, you could catch me just stand, like when it rained, like standing on the street corners looking at the water going down the drain and just seeing how it behaved.
As I'm asking, please can we go inside?
But so like there's lots of examples of things like that where I just get captivated because now I like there are lots of little things that you would normally see all over, you know. You'd see water in a stream going, you know, and then becoming turbulent, and when it goes across some rocks or something like that, and like things like that, where I think about, like, I think a lot more about everyday things in a different way because of that. So that's just an example of fluid dynamics. I also think like relativity. I think about in weird ways affecting, like, obviously I don't think not in the sense of moving as fast as the speed of light, but in terms of like the philosophical concepts of relativity, of that. Everybody's point of view, you know, has just a basic physical law. Everybody's point of view has to essentially be just as valid.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an interesting way to think about the universe, and it forces you to think in that way. And it forces me to be more open-minded and think about how other people look at things. Because that's, I know it's kind of like a weird way of thinking about that, but because studying relativity forces you to think in that way about how other people would do the same measurement and how they get different answers, but they're really getting the same answer. It kind of is. It does kind of force your brain to think that way a little bit more. Anyway, those are the two examples that I can think of. Okay, that was my question. All right, mm-hmm. You have one more for me?
I do. It's a little bit tongue in cheek, but I actually kind of like it. So you can choose to edit this out later or not. What is?
This is going to be a good one.
All right. What is the biggest up-and-coming astronomical discovery?
What is the biggest up-and-coming astronomical discovery?
Yeah.
What are the... Oh, man. If I knew that...
Can you let me know, please?
The next big discovery... Well, okay. I'll just answer this with, I'll give a perfect cop-out answer, which is that the biggest, best discoveries are especially in astrophysics, are almost always on accident. Well, you know, we built the Vera Rubin Observatory, I say we, I didn't help, but when we did that, you know, we have all these planned reasons for it, things that we specifically want to go after, but really we know, every one of us knows, that the really big discoveries are going to be the things that we didn't expect to see.
Absolutely.
And in astrophysics, that's almost always how it works, is you discover something, you know, almost anything in astrophysics is an accidental discovery when you were looking at something else. Or looking for something else. Yep. And so I think that's, in a basic sense, there's no way mm-hmm. we can know what the next big discovery is, but that, you know, but it almost certainly, the way to find it is by looking at the universe in a way that you haven't looked at it before, mm-hmm. and you'll find things that you never expected to see.
Absolutely. I like, you know, thinking about what our next discovery engines are, and we're not going to be able to predict what cool things they're going to find. We can try to be ready to model those wavelength regimes, that kind of thing. But for the most part, we push to view the universe in new and exciting ways.
Excellent. So, all right. Here's my final question. So every episode for the past 2 years, mm-hmm. I've always one of the last questions I've asked. By the way, how many episodes of the podcast have you listened to?
At least half.
At least half? Okay. So you've heard through many of them.
I stopped having a commute, so I...
That's fine. You don't have to listen. None of you have to listen. It's fine. If you want to unsubscribe, it's okay. I won't be personally offended. The podcast. So yeah. So one of the last questions I always ask is, in your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics? And I'm curious because mm-hmm. there's a wide range of answers to mm-hmm. that, and you've heard many of them.
And you've asked me this before. I think you cut it out of my episode though. So
did I? Yeah. Possible. I'm sorry.
You don't like my answer.
No, but go on. Do you have any takeaways from the different answers? Like, is there a particular answer that you like, or a particular answer you think is you don't, or is there a particular answer you're like, everybody seems to answer this, or?
Well, I can say I like hearing that our answers fall into a couple different categories. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who answer immediately with the practical things, right. Like what things we have provided as astronomers who have changed your life, things like cameras or the internet, mm-hmm. right? Those are all because
more
astronomers needed to invent
that did
them.
The internet, but you know.
Whatever. <That's> I'll okay. take credit for it.
All right.
So that's one category. The other category is a little more interpersonal mm-hmm. or existential even of, you know, because humans are curious and we want to know where we came from, mm-hmm. right? And you should fund that. And then there's a third category of kind of the tongue-in-cheek of, well, I don't know, or like we really shouldn't more than other things, but that's kind of the point of human nature, right?
Right.
And I think all three of those categories are totally valid.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably are the drive for different scientists. But
I don't know. I think it's funny because I'll ask that question and I think people will take it differently, the question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people will try to give me a reason that they would pitch to keep their astrophysics going. But it may not be the reason they actually care about astrophysics, right?
Normally
it
isn't.
The reasons you pitch to somebody for why they should care about astrophysics are usually different from the reasons mm-hmm. that an astrophysicist would actually care about them, which really is usually because it's really interesting and cool and I want to know more about it, and who wouldn't want to know about these things? So in terms of the practical answers, here's the funny thing. So when the practical answers, the most common practical application of astrophysics that comes up is GPS satellites.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason people give that example is because you need general relativity mm-hmm. to account, or at least there is, these GPS satellites operate by having extremely precise clocks, and that you can use that to triangulate signals coming from different satellites to determine where on the Earth you are. And those extremely precise clocks need to be calibrated so precisely they need to take into account the effects of general relativity, or basically none of it would work. And that's all true, but it's kind of funny because I think it's a perfect example of that dichotomy, because you know, you're explaining this to people, like, somebody, why should we be funding astrophysics? Why should you care about general relativity? Because the reason they usually explain that reason is because general relativity is often thought to be like a very
esoteric, untouchable,
not practical science. You know, there's nothing you can do with that, right? Mm-hmm. So they say, oh, don't worry, you can do things with it. Look, GPS satellites need general relativity. And they say, okay, why do they need general relativity? And you say, well, because the Earth warps space-time and it causes time to run at a different rate at different altitudes. And you go, hang on, I think you're kind of burying the lead there, right? Like, you're telling me that space-time, the time is warped by the Earth's gravitational field, and if you stand on a mountaintop, time runs at a different rate than if you're standing on, like, sea level. And it's like, yes, that's right. It's like, so why are you talking to me about GPS satellites? To me, like, that's way more interesting to me, the fact that...
Because without GPS, we might not know.
Time is warped by Earth's gravitational field, and you're talking about GPS, we should be understanding why that is and really getting into it, you know. So to me, like, that sort of really helps drive home the concept of, like, you know, it's funny to, like, pitch it as, like, a reason to, because we'll better calibrate the clocks on GPS satellites, which, by the way, you can do with just a fudge factor. But, you know, like... If I always find that as a funny reason to pitch, because it's like, you know, you're not, you know, it's this really crazy phenomenon, right, that time travels differently in the atmosphere than it does on the surface, yep, of the Earth, very slightly.
I do think it's a gut instinct to answer that way, because in this current climate of, we're unsure that astronomy is going to get to continue because the money is disappearing.
Well, in the U.S., we're not sure that it's going to continue.
If all of the U.S. satellites die globally, it still takes a hit, right?
Sure.
And so I think that's why people give that gut answer of trying to justify our existence with things you really need, like your digital cameras or your GPS.
I mean, that's why you'll find especially scientists ready with that answer,
right?
To explain, like, in terms of practical money, things that are worth dollars to people, because the person they're talking to might not care about space at all. So anyway, I just thought I'd bring that up. It's one that I always find that answer, the GPS answer, so funny for that reason. But yeah, okay. Do we have anything else?
I don't need to have anything else.
Okay.
We'll save them for next time.
We'll just end really awkwardly.
But you want my answer? You can edit it out later.
Well, so first of all, you've given your answer before.
Yeah, but you edited it out.
Oh, okay. Can I try to say what I remember it being?
Yeah.
That you basically think it's astrophysics is not fundamentally, you shouldn't be funding it because for practical reasons, that it's, you can think of it in the same category as art or, you know, other things that may not have immediate practical consequences, but we as a society, society that's well off enough, that's doing well, can be that's a measure of how successful a society is that they're willing to put funding into things that are not immediately helping the society.
We know, you know, you get to a point where, you know, in human evolution, you find a river, so you get to have a little bit easier life because you figure out how to farm, and then you get some free time, and then you get to start studying things and learning things, and then you become well off enough that, we can pay attention to things that are not immediately going to affect us, life and death. And right, that's when you get the richness of the common era of human nature.
Right. Okay, I will keep it in this time.
You don't have to.
No, I will keep it in. That's good. All right, so then you've left me with a good place to end. So thank you so much, Dr. Pollan, for joining me. I had a lot of fun answering all these questions with you, and I know you'll join me again sometime.
Of course.
Well, I can say one thing for sure. We have a lot of fun doing these Astro Q&A episodes. Next month, we'll be back with an interview with another amazing astrophysicist. But if you still have astrophysics questions, find us on social media and ask away. So thank you again to Dr. Pollan, and thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. All the music you hear on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford from her album Trotter. All songs were used with permission from the artist and producer. Look up Britton Ashford if you enjoyed the music. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana by me, Paul Duffel, professor of physics and astronomy at Purdue University.